Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Sarah Williams reporting. Germany's parliament has voted overwhelmingly to send military aid to the fight against Islamic State militants in Syria, answering France's appeal for help after last month's deadly Paris attacks. Lawmakers in Berlin voted 445 to 146 Friday to send Tornado reconnaissance jets, a frigate, refueling aircraft, and up to 1,200 military personnel to join the coalition against IS. However, German pilots will not join U.S., British, French, and Russian airstrikes against Islamic State targets in Syria. While investigators in the western U.S. state of California sort through a possible motive for a husband and wife killing 14 people at a holiday party, the community is gathering to begin some healing. A large crowd attended a candlelight vigil Thursday night in San Bernardino to remember the victims, including 21 wounded Wednesday at a social service center for the disabled. Pastor Joshua Beckley of the Ecclesia Christian Fellowship addressed the crowd.
We may be perplexed. We may not understand why. We may be a little bit confused, but we will not fall into despair.
Police displayed some of the ammunition and firearms recovered from the couple's vehicle after they were killed in a gun battle with officers. One of the first officers on the scene Wednesday described the aftermath of the rampage.
It was unspeakable, the carnage that we were seeing, the number of people who were injured and unfortunately already dead, and the pure panic on the face of those individuals that were still in need and needing to be safe.
VOA News. Egyptian officials say at least 16 people were killed early Friday in a Molotov cocktail attack on a nightclub in Cairo. A motive has not been determined for the firebombing, which occurred at the Al Sayed restaurant and bar in the Aguza neighborhood. Security officials deny the attack was terrorist-related, but have provided several apparently conflicting statements. The Interior Ministry said the incident began with a disagreement between nightclub staff and others who then bombed the entrance. OPEC ministers are meeting Friday in Vienna, where they will decide whether to slash production to help raise oil prices that have fallen to extreme lows. Most market analysts expect members of the 12-nation global oil cartel to maintain production levels. Ahead of the semi-annual meeting, OPEC's biggest producer, Saudi Arabia, defied calls to slash output in hopes of protecting its share of the market. OPEC nations are faced with a massive surplus of oil, sending prices plunging more than 60% in the last year and a half. The surplus could soon become more severe. The U.S. economy had a net gain of 211,000 jobs in November, while the unemployment rate held steady at a 7.5-year low of 5%. Friday's government report says jobs gains were seen in construction, professional services, and healthcare. Mining and some media companies lost jobs. U.S. businesses have added 13.7 million jobs in a little less than 6 years. But White House economic advisor Jason Furman says that we have a lot more work to do. 7.9 million Americans are still out of work, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says the United States has never had any doubt that Iran conducted work on nuclear weapons, following a U.N. report that said Iran worked for more than a decade ago on developing atomic weapons. However, Kerry said Friday the real issue is now what will Iran do to adhere to the landmark nuclear pact that Iran and six world powers signed in July. Kerry would not comment on an International Atomic Energy Agency report that said Iran conducted most of its coordinated work on developing nuclear weapons prior to the end of 2003. Officials in Afghanistan say at least 9 civilians were killed and 6 more wounded when a mortar shell fired by Afghan forces hit a mosque on Friday. In another development, U.S. and local forces jointly assaulted a Taliban-held prison in a volatile southern region and freed more than 40 Afghan security personnel. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening, and welcome to Africa News Tonight, from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Joe DiCapua in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Thousands of United Nations soldiers and police are trying to end or at least contain the sectarian conflict in the Central African Republic. To do that, however, they'll need to deal with the country's warring militias, as well as the rumor mill.
That's Chris Stein reporting. Details coming up. We'll also hear from the head of mission for Doctors Without Borders in CAR about the humanitarian crisis there. Also in the news, over 4,500 people flee into the eastern DRC to escape fighting in South Sudan's western Equatoria region. And Syrian refugees may have the legal edge over Africans in seeking European asylum. We'll have these stories plus the sunny side of sports, music, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, more than 4,600 people have fled recent fighting in South Sudan's western Equatoria region. They crossed the border into the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. The fighting is between local groups known as Arrow Boys and the South Sudanese Army. The Arrow Boys began as vigilante groups that formed to fight LRA rebels from Uganda. Their weapons were bows and arrows. The UN Refugee Agency, the UNHCR, says this week it registered over 3,400 South Sudanese in DRC's Dungu territory. Nearly all of them are women and children. Some walked for 3 days to cross the border. The UN agency says most of the men remained in South Sudan. The majority of the South Sudanese refugees are being sheltered by local families. Others have also fled the fighting in the western Equatoria region. The UNHCR says more than 1,200 Congolese who had been refugees in South Sudan's Ezo settlement have returned to the DRC. Many others who left Ezo have fled into the bush. The U.S. government has announced $24 million in aid to provide food, water, and shelter for migrants and refugees who face a long, cold winter in Europe. Secretary of State John Kerry announced the aid today in Athens, Greece. The aid package will be managed by the UN Refugee Agency that is coordinating relief for more than 700,000 migrants and refugees. The Greek islands in the Aegean have been the gateway to Europe for most of the migrants and refugees in recent months. The largest population flows in recent months have come through Greece from conflicts in Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq. Also, officials in the Netherlands have arrested an 18-year-old Syrian refugee as a suspected member of the terrorist organization Al-Qaeda. In Cairo, a Molotov cocktail attack on a nightclub early this morning has left at least 16 people dead and several wounded. Egyptian officials say the attack was on the Issaïd restaurant and bar in the Aghouza neighborhood. The Interior Ministry says the firebombing followed a disagreement between nightclub staff and others. An official told Reuters news agency that one of the attackers was an employee who was recently fired. Security officials deny the attack was terrorist-related. The Maine State News Agency had quoted an official earlier who said three men on a motorcycle threw the firebomb and fled the scene. A manhunt is underway. The migrant and refugee exodus from Africa to Europe began last year. Much attention has been paid to the dangerous and often fatal boat journeys across the Mediterranean. But now, refugees from years of war in Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq have changed the character of Europe's migrant crisis. Courts in many European Union countries have started sending back some of the 200,000 Africans who may not qualify for political asylum. VOA's David Arnold has the story.
The migrant crisis began last year when sub-Saharan Africans began shipping out in rickety boats from the coast of Libya. Smugglers had a brisk business with migrants escaping terrorists, forced and lengthy military conscription, and rampant unemployment. The numbers crossing the Mediterranean from Libya to Italy rose. but suddenly others from Middle Eastern countries began landing on Greek islands. Deputy Director of Amnesty International's Europe and Central Asia office, Gary Vangulik, calls the shift dramatic.
Now, because there are so many Syrians, for example, as part of this group, it's clear that they are refugees, and that sort of changed the discussion. Now, I share a concern that many have, which is that we've forgotten a little bit about that initial group. There are still many refugees coming from sub-Saharan African countries. And what we've seen is sort of a discriminatory approach, if you will, towards sort of favoring Syrian refugees. That's problematic.
Each European country that admits refugees and migrants decides how to handle those who choose to stay. And each country decides who will go home and who might face political persecution. Vangulik fears that some governments are automatically taking Middle East refugees and denying safe harbor to some Africans who face equal peril at home.
What we need to see in each of these countries as people arrive is a fair and full assessment of every individual's claim for asylum. And the big risk that we flag as Amnesty is that we're going to see blanket refusals of people purely because of where they're from. We're very worried that we lose that very basic fundamental principle of international law, which is those who need protection should get it. That seems to be slipping away, and we're deeply concerned that because of this overemphasis on certain nationalities, we're going to risk sending people back to conflict situations and to persecution. And that is a very fundamental violation of their human rights.
Hungary is one of several countries that has decided that country of origin is the only test necessary. If you entered Hungary from a so-called safe country in the Balkans, you are automatically returned. Africans are not the only victims of this swift justice, Vangulik says.
Hungary has just changed its laws and has basically declared any person who comes through a safe country be sent back. What that means is they've declared certain countries like Serbia as safe countries, and so anyone traveling through Serbia is automatically sent back. Now, that means 98% of people. And in the Balkans, what we saw is problems, in Serbia and Macedonia, with people being pushed back, so that means without any checks of their case, just being sent back over the border wherever they came from.
The migrant population of Europe has swollen to almost a million in the last 12 months. Countries that have a history of welcoming migrants and refugees are now tightening their borders. Even the most generous governments are making judgments based on nationality, not politics.
People from Syria, for example, we know that they are refugees. We have there doesn't need to be as strong, as long an asylum process as for some of the others. Germany is assessing everyone individually, but they're also facing a big backlog now. As you think, like 800,000 people have to be processed. That takes a lot of time. But the only big problem in Germany is that they have also now adopted the issue of safe countries again. That means that they're going to send everyone who comes from Albania, for example, or Serbia, straight back.
Sweden has been a haven for refugees for years. But as Amnesty International reports this week that Eritreans have a right to international protection, Vangulik says Sweden is shutting its door.
Sweden has always been at the forefront of hospitality, frankly. They've high number of asylum seekers in the country. They take on really a disproportionate amount of refugees. And sadly, they've now declared that they are not going to take more people. In some sense, understandable, because Europe is paralyzed. Europe is not dividing this responsibility properly.
Even if migrants get their day in a European court, judges will find it difficult to understand the social and political landscape of a migrant's plea. Vangulik remembers why a judge sent a girl back to Sierra Leone.
A few years ago, I remember following the case of a woman from Sierra Leone, and I found it interesting because I remember the judge asking her, "Were you really raped?" And she said, "Yes." And then the judge asked, "Well, but wouldn't you have told your family about it?" In the end, he ruled that it was not credible because she hadn't told her family. Now, anyone working with survivors of sexual violence can tell you that they don't often tell anyone, let alone male family members.
Many of the estimated 200,000 Africans may not have their day in a European court. Instead, they're likely to be returning home on a plane with a ticket paid for by the country that decides they had no right to stay. This is David Arnold reporting for VOA from Washington, D.C.
Central African Republic is scheduled to hold elections at the end of the month, but a leading African think tank says the country is too dangerous to hold a free and fair vote. The Institute of Security Studies says CAR officials cannot guarantee security or an accurate voter roll. It also says militia groups cannot be disarmed by December 27th. Meanwhile, the recent visit by Pope Francis to Bangui raised hopes the country could move toward peace after years of violence between Muslim rebels and Christian militias. However, the medical aid group Doctors Without Borders says the humanitarian crisis in CAR remains critical. Nearly 500,000 people are displaced within the country, and another 500,000 are refugees in neighboring countries. Thierry Dumont is head of the mission for the group, also known by the French acronym MSF. From Bangui, he spoke to me about why the crisis lingers.
It's a long story. You know, CAR have been in humanitarian trouble, I would say, for many years. And already in 2011, we said that in a report called a silent crisis. And then in addition, you had another crisis on top of that in 2012 until now. So that's why CAR is still in big trouble.
What specifically are you seeing at this stage?
You know, we are a humanitarian medical organization, so what we see is people facing difficulties to be treated, to have access to health care. And on our side, sometimes we have difficulties as well to give support to the people who need to get some support.
How widespread are MSF operations in the Central African Republic?
We start working in CAR 20 years ago. And we are having 17 different projects all over the country. We employ 2,300 Central African people, and it's about 240 expatriates, volunteers, working in CAR.
Are you seeing the same problems at all 17 MSF projects?
No, it's different. In the western part, for example, close to the border with Cameroon, it has been very quiet since, I would say, May 2014. We can work normally. We work in health centers outside of the main city there. But in Bangui, it's different. Bangui, I would say, it's up and down. It can be quiet until September 2015. We saw that the situation was improving, and by sudden, we had this violence. And I think we lost a lot at that time.
Do you think Pope Francis's recent visit will have any effect?
Well, at least it had an effect, a very positive effect during 48 hours, I would say. But the night after he left, somebody already was killed in the famous PK5. So I think it's good that he came. But was he able to change everything? I'm not sure of that. You had the situation in Bangui. But then you have the situation in Bambari or in Kagabandoro or in Batangafo, in other parts of the country. And I'm afraid there that they don't really pay so much attention at the visit of the Pope.
What do you think needs to be done to at least ensure that MSF is able to do its work?
To be able to do our work, in fact, we need two things. We need to be able to provide care, but we need the people as well, the patients, to be able to go freely to our places. So it's a two-way situation. It's not only protecting us, it's also protecting the patients. So we need more security, I would say.
How do you feel about the security at your clinics? I know in some other countries, like South Sudan, the clinics are often in danger. What about in CAR?
It's pretty okay. It's pretty okay. We did a lot of communication. Every week we do a round table with a different network, and we do our best to explain people who we are, why we are there, and that we are neutral, and so and so and so. And I was telling you that we are here working for 20 years now. So I think for our visibility as well, it's very important. So I would say that NSF is pretty well accepted, pretty well known. We have a good reputation here in Carr, but you will always have people who don't really care. Last week, we had a car stolen in Bangui, and the week before, another car was stolen from us close to the airport. So the thing is, you have poverty here, extreme poverty. Some people don't really care about others. They care about themselves. They just think about the profit they can get from an organization like NSF, and they steal whatever they can.
Aside from the wounds that you treat because of the violence in the country, what are the major health concerns for Central African Republic?
I would say malaria is coming first. Then we have, of course, HIV, TB programs, maternity as well. And we are mainly focused on kids, you know, below 5 years old. Another major activity is vaccination, because vaccination coverage in CAR is pretty low, and mainly because of the security condition for the last 3 years.
Thierry Dumont is head of the mission for the group, also known by the French acronym MSF, Doctors Without Borders. He spoke from Bangui. In other news for the CAR, thousands of UN soldiers and police are trying to end or at least contain the sectarian conflict. However, to do that, they must not only deal with the country's warring militias, but the rumor mill as well. Chris Stein reports from the capital, Bangui.
Guillermo Bokomo is a charity worker who lives in Bangui's Fatima neighborhood. Fatima has been the scene of clashes between Muslim and Christian militias, including an attack on a church last year that killed at least 17 people. Soldiers from Burundi are stationed in the neighborhood as part of the United Nations peacekeeping mission, but Bokomo says they haven't been able to stop fighting from breaking out in Fatima. He's even heard rumors that the Burundian peacekeepers transport fighters from the nearby Muslim neighborhood to carry out attacks. If a rumor is repeated over and over, and it's the same rumor, then there must be some truth to it, he says. It's not uncommon to hear such rumors about the UN peacekeeping mission, known as MINUSCA. Launched in September 2014, more than 11,000 police and soldiers are deployed across the country, trying to contain the violence. Luis Carrillo, the commissioner of the UN police force in the country, wouldn't address the topic of rumors directly, but said MINUSCA is committed to keeping the country safe.
There are always events that it's impossible to prevent, even if you have one police officer in each house or in each street. It's the community that needs to be balanced.
Clashes, however, continue. More than 100 people have been killed around one Bangui neighborhood since September, Human Rights Watch reported last month. The heads of the Central African Regional Bloc in November called for more troops for the mission. Meanwhile, several people have accused MINUSCA troops of sexual abuse. French troops stationed in the country have faced similar allegations. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon fired MINUSCA's head after the claims came to light earlier this year. Ilaria Alagrozi, the Central African researcher for Amnesty International, says MINUSCA must do a better job of explaining its mandate if it wants to win over residents like Bokomo.
Address these perception problems will be very important and can be done, for example, by conducting regular surveys among the affected communities and to make sure that, you know, perception expectations of the people inform also the protection strategies of the mission.
UN peacekeepers scored a major success during the recent visit to Bangui of Pope Francis. No major security incidents were reported during his trip. Their next challenge will be to keep people safe during the constitutional referendum planned for December 13th. Chris Stein for VOA News, Bangui.
Chinese President Xi Jinping is offering African nations $60 billion in loans, foreign aid, and debt forgiveness over 3 years. The figure is double the development package announced last year for Africa. The Chinese leader made that announcement today at the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation Summit in Johannesburg. China is stepping up surveillance of pro-democracy activists in Hong Kong, and it's using very sophisticated methods. But as Shannon Van Sant reports, it's not clear whether that surveillance is state-sponsored or the work of private, individual hackers.
A year after pro-democracy protests filled the streets of Hong Kong, the city has become a target of multiple and sophisticated cyber attacks. Hong Kong's cybersecurity watchdog Hong Kong Computer Emergency Response Team says there has been a 38% rise in hacking attacks since last year. Nicholas Thomas, a professor at the City University of Hong Kong, says it is unclear who is behind these cyber attacks.
There's been no direct, on our side, at least on the Hong Kong side, there's been no direct tie with what's going on to the Chinese government or any government agencies. That's possible, of course, but it equally could simply be Chinese hacker groups who are displaying some fairly nationalist tendencies in cyberspace who are doing this under their own steam.
Since August of last year, there have been more than 1,175 phishing attacks where users' data and computers are compromised after clicking on an attachment to an email. But cyber attacks in the city have not been limited to phishing methods. Western security experts say hackers are using more sophisticated techniques, such as Google Drive and Dropbox, to hack into democracy activist devices. Hackers are also using Whitelist, which compromised the data of certain visitors to some websites.
What we do know is it's a pretty sophisticated attack that's taking place. I mean, they're deliberately using Dropbox and also Google Drive to install malware. Or sort of two types of malware, really. And what's going on there is they're using the cloud aspect of Google Drive and Dropbox to mask what they're actually doing.
Victims of the recent spate of cyber attacks include activists, university professors, and journalists. And Western security firms such as FireEye say the sophisticated hacking techniques are commonly used by China and Russia. Tom Grundy, the founder of Hong Kong Free Press, says his website came under attack just before its launch.
It was a DDoS, a denial of service attack, a surge of traffic that seemingly had a human being, you know, behind it. Now I think we've probably the most secure news website in Hong Kong. So, you know, we recognize vulnerability and others such as Apple Daily, you know, have been attacked a lot more viciously. So we're prepared in some sense for that. But, you know, Hong Kong is meant to be the first and last bastion of freedom of expression and speech and a free press in Greater China. So, you know, a lot of us in the media and beyond are concerned about this.
It is cyber attacks like these that have made Hong Kong the most targeted region in Asia since last year's umbrella movement, according to some security firms. Hong Kong's Democratic Party says it has been the victim of multiple hacking attacks over the last year. For lawmaker Emily Lau, surveillance has become a way of life.
Surveillance, I always feel that I am, even now that I'm talking to you. I think some people know that. And of course, I have nothing to hide. I always say that my life is an open book and I walk around Hong Kong on my own.
It's an attitude that may be necessary for many of Hong Kong's pro-democracy activists to adopt. Shannon Van Sant for VOA News, Hong Kong.
Africa News Tonight, I'm Joe DiCapua in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News, coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to Africa News Tonight for the latest sports, features, and more, coming up right here on the VOA. For the full hour of Africa News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views, presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us, free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Over 4,600 people flee fighting in South Sudan's western Equatoria region for the DRC. Amnesty International says Africans may lose out to Syrians in a bid to get European political asylum. And Doctors Without Borders says the humanitarian crisis in the Central African Republic remains at critical levels. Coming up, music from Sierra Leone and in our feature segment, South Sudanese Heroes in Australia. I'm Joe DiCapua. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. Well, they don't get a chance to do this very often anymore, right? Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sonny Young. Hello, Sonny.
Hello, Joe. Great to have you back in the studio.
It's nice to be back in the saddle here.
Well, Joe, we're going to talk about the Big Apple, New York City. It's known as one of the big melting pots here in the United States. People from all over the world live in New York, attracted to its vibrant arts, entertainment, business, and yes, sports scenes. One men's college basketball team in New York symbolizes the city's multicultural nature. Brooklyn's Long Island University, known as LIU, has players from Iceland, the Netherlands, Nigeria, Senegal, and Central African Republic. VOA's Bernard Schussman joins us now from New York with this feature on the team.
The team is the Blackbirds. They play in the Northeast Conference that has 21 foreign-born players, five of them at LIU. 20-year-old Nura Zana is from Nigeria. His goal is to play in the National Basketball Association, the top basketball league in the world. But Zana knows there's more to basketball than playing the game.
Hopefully, you know, if I can get a job in the NBA, like an international department job, so, you know, we can help basketball more global, you know, in Africa, and promote the game more in Africa, and, you know, help more kids.
One of his teammates is Glenn Fidanga. This 21-year-old college junior is from the Central African Republic.
Like a lot of kids in Africa, they're dreaming to come here, but they're not lucky enough to get a chance to come. But I was one of the lucky ones to get a chance to come to the United States.
One of the youngest players on the team is 18-year-old Ganlando Cisse. He's from Senegal. His goal is to play professionally in Europe. Cisse is learning to be independent.
Like college is a lot of different new thing. Like you have to manage your time, your school, your work, basketball court. I mean, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. So I'm handling it right now.
Get your head, home run first.
Jack Perry has been LIU's head coach for 4 years. He believes strongly in gathering information about possible basketball recruits, no matter where they're from.
Now, obviously, you want to get a kid that's athletic, that has potential on the basketball court. But we also look at other things, how they handle adversity. Are they constantly whining and complaining or making excuses, that kind of stuff on the court? How do they handle situations with their parents, teachers and things like that?
3 out of the last 5 years, the Blackbirds have been champions of their conference. Perry believes his international team is on track to achieve some of the same glory that LIU has enjoyed in its past basketball history.
He's going to fire it now for three. Good!
Bernard Schussman, VOA News, Brooklyn, New York.
Yeah, I'm out at Brooklyn. Now I'm down in Tribeca, right next to the Narrow. But I'll be hood forever. I'm the new Sinatra. And since I made it here, I can make it anywhere. Yeah, they love me everywhere. I used to cop in Harlem. All of my Dominicanos right there up on Broadway. Pulled me back to that McDonald's. Took it to my stash spot, 560 State Street. Catch me in the kitchen like a Simmons whipping pastry. Cruising down A Street, off-white Lexus. Driving so slow, but BK is from Texas. Me, I'm out that Bed-Stuy, home of that boy B. Biggie. Now I live on Billboard, and I brought my boys with me. Say what up to Tata, still sipping my top. Sitting courtside, Knicks and Nets give me high five. I be spiked out, I could trip a referee. Tell by my attitude that I most definitely from.
Jay-Z rapped about sitting courtside for the Knicks and the Nets. Those are the two NBA clubs in New York City. The Knicks feature a big Latvian player, 2.21 meters tall, Kristaps Porzingis, who was one of the most talked about big men in the league this season. The 20-year-old Porzingis has been very impressive in his first NBA season. He's averaging about 14 points and 9 rebounds a game. Porzingis was named the Eastern Conference's Rookie of the Month for November. Minnesota Timberwolves center Karl Anthony Towns was named the NBA's Western Conference Rookie of the Month. In NBA action Thursday night, the Miami Heat edged the visiting Oklahoma City Thunder 97-95. It was a wild back-and-forth game that featured 38 lead changes and 11 ties. Miami's star guard Dwayne Wade scored 28 points, including two free throws with less than 2 seconds left in the game to put the Heat ahead to stay. Russell Westbrook and Kevin Durant each scored 25 points for Oklahoma City, which misfired on a pair of three-point shots in the final 10 seconds. In other NBA results Thursday, the Orlando Magic defeated the Utah Jazz 103-94. The San Antonio Spurs beat the Memphis Grizzlies 103-83. The Portland Trail Blazers topped the Indiana Pacers 123-111. The Boston Celtics beat the Sacramento Kings 114-97. And the Denver Nuggets edged the host Toronto Raptors 106-105. Now the Raptors will be at home again on Saturday when they try to stop the record-winning streak of the defending NBA champion Golden State Warriors. Led by sharpshooting guard Stephen Curry, the league's reigning most valuable player, the Warriors have won their first 20 games, the best ever start in NBA history.
They're playing back.
G'day, mates. Remember me? This is the old sports emperor with a red-hot listening tip. That's right. Give a listen to my pal, the bright and lively sunny man on the sunny side of sports, right here on the Voice of America.
Thanks for that red-hot listening tip, Barry. Our loyal and longtime Voice of America listeners will sometimes ask me, Sonny, what is Barry up to these days? Well, he's enjoying retirement in the southern U.S. state of Georgia. Football news now on the VOA. The alleged corruption at football's world governing body, FIFA, plunged to new depths this week when U.S. authorities charged more than a dozen officials with embezzling money from the organization. Two FIFA vice presidents were arrested in Switzerland, even as the body's executive committee met to discuss key reforms. Henry Ridgewell joins us now with a report from London.
This week was meant to mark a new chapter for FIFA. A key vote was approved on reforms designed to turn it into a trusted and professional sports organisation. Instead, the scale of that task was made clear as 16 FIFA officials were charged Thursday by US authorities who alleged that huge sums were siphoned off, intended to help natural disaster relief and grassroots football programmes, and lucrative media rights sold off for bribes. The charges target several of the most senior football executives in South and Central America. U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch said huge sums were involved.
The scale of corruption alleged herein is unconscionable. And the message from this announcement should be clear to every culpable individual who remains in the shadows, hoping to evade this ongoing investigation. You will not wait us out, and you will not escape our focus.
The U.S. charges came hours after the arrest of two FIFA vice presidents by Swiss police. The allegations lay bare the hypocrisy at the heart of FIFA, says sports historian Philip Barker, who spoke to VOA via Skype.
It's the kind of coaching facilities that they're setting up, the coaching expertise that they're sending in. It all does come across rather empty when it turns out that people are actually enriching themselves from the funds that are supposed to be helping football at the grassroots. It's very disturbing.
11 current and former members of FIFA's executive committee have been charged in the US investigation. The acting president of FIFA, Issa Hayatou, pledged full cooperation.
Les événements qui se sont déroulés ce matin.
Hayatou said that the arrests underscore the necessity to establish a complete program of reforms for FIFA. Those reforms include reducing the power of FIFA's executive committee and greater transparency. The body is due to elect a new president in February, but the criminal investigations could engulf that process, says Barker.
This is one of the big problems with the FIFA investigations, that those who were perceived as being the new broom that might help to clean out the house have also been subject to allegations.
Meanwhile, former President Sepp Blatter is suspended as part of a separate investigation by Swiss authorities into a $2 million payment to European soccer head Michel Platini. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Thanks, Henry. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. Joining me once again, Joe DiCapua. Joe, we heard from Bernard Schussman at the top with that multicultural basketball team in New York. You got some ties to New York,
That's
don't
right.
you?
He was in Brooklyn, so I want to give a shout out to Brooklyn's neighbor, Queens, and my home neighborhood of Maspeth.
Okay.
So I'm sure they're listening. And I want to ask you a question about FIFA. You think it'll ever stand for Former Influential Football Association?
That acronym might fit it a little better, Joe. Anyways, yeah, that's all for now. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Joe DiCapua.
Why, thank you, Sonny. You can listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And, of course, on Fridays, today, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17 hours UTC right here in the VOA. I'm Joe DiCapua in Washington. Well, time now for a little music. And in tonight's music segment, we feature Sierra Leone's Refugee All-Stars with Work It Brighter.
Mystic them flow around them, cannot notice. Shepherd is calling all his flock. Ready to shiver the air from the grave. Only to rebuild the walls of Zion. Walls of Shepherd is calling all his flock, ready to shiver the air from the grave, only to reveal the walls of Zion. Walls of with men's wars and evil ways.
it right down. Take it or leave it now.
It's a love affair. He only walk it right down.
Promises you have me,
please try to fulfill them.
Promises you have me,
please try to fulfill them.
No matter what the constraint,
just put your people interest first.
No matter what the constraint,
just put your country interest first.
Then you walk it brighter.
Walk it brighter. You walk it brighter. Walk it brighter. Just brighter than the former. And brighter for our future. You walk it brighter. You walk it brighter.
That was Sierra Leone's Refugee All-Stars with Work It Brighter. Well, in Canberra, Australia, two South Sudanese-born residents are being called heroes after they disarmed a man who was waving a machete at innocent bystanders. Several people were injured in that incident. Ayen Bior has the story.
John Majura Kwok and Gutch Kot say it was a very normal Thursday night on November 12th when the two were headed home after watching a professional soccer match in Canberra. They hailed a taxi and both jumped into the back seat. Majura Kwok was sitting behind the driver and Kot was on the passenger side. They say they were traveling in moderate traffic when suddenly the taxi driver slammed on his brakes. Both say a man wielding a machete jumped right in front of their taxi. He then jumped over to the passenger side and began attacking the cab driver with the machete. Kot said that's when he knew he had to do something.
I just jumped out quickly, and at the time I assessed the whole street quickly because I'm very familiar with that area. All I could see was just a lot of vulnerable people on the street, children and their families, you know, walking out.
Majura Kwok says the cab driver's screams were deafening.
And the taxi driver was just crying out, "Help, help, he stuffed me." So I jumped out from the other side and Gotch jumped out from behind. And because he was on the other side, he was the first person to get there.
While Majura Kwok was helping the taxi driver, Kot says he knew that more lives would be in danger unless they apprehended the suspect.
Survival instinct just kicked in. I was like, whoever gets to the knife first gets to live in. I managed to get to the knife first and just pushed it away just turned him on his back and used my body to restrain him.
Majura Kwok says being in life-threatening situations is not new to him. He became a refugee as a young boy and had to leave his homeland during Sudan's Second Civil War. He eventually moved to Kakuma Refugee Camp. He says growing up there taught him he had to toughen up if he was going to survive.
So, you know, when I used to live there, things like this, you know, the incident that I was involved, you know, used to happen, and you just had to depend yourself and sometimes depend other people from being hurt by other people or being harmed by other people.
Majora Kwok does not consider himself a hero. He says he's just one human being helping other human beings. He says he's just glad he could help. Kut agrees.
I don't see myself as an heroic figure or some sort of like an important person. I just think that, you know, the way I was brought up with ethics, you should do the right thing when you're required.
Majora Kwok says the suspect appeared to be mentally unstable. Court documents showed the suspect stated he had no recollection of the attack. He was charged with possessing a dangerous weapon with the intent of using the weapon against others. He was also charged with intentionally wounding and damaging property. The suspect is due to appear in court in 5 months. For VOA News, I'm Ian Bior in Washington.
Nigeria's prolific film industry, Nollywood, churns out more than 3,000 movies every year. But despite that, the 30-year-old movie industry has problems making a profit, all because of piracy. VOA's Paul Ndio has the story.
Nollywood is a $5 billion industry. Film producer Sam Boye is on the set taking his actors through their paces before shooting begins on his latest production, a soap opera about family feuds. Boye has been involved in Nollywood films for nearly 30 years. He says that rampant piracy is the main reason film producers are barely making any money.
A producer was in China. He was in China and he said he saw our movie on, they call it 20 in one, that you have 20 movies in one DVD. In China, that is, it's been dubbed into Chinese language without the consent of the producers.
Nollywood is best known for the quantity of film it produces, but not quality. But there are those who are trying to change things. Producer-director Kunle Afoloyan is the filmmaker behind October 1st. Nollywood's film is set in 1960, against the backdrop of Nigeria's independence from Britain. The movie tells the story of a detective who is dispatched by the British colonial masters to a remote town in the western region of Nigeria to solve a series of murders that caused outrage in the community. With three films under his belt, Afoloyan has earned a reputation in Nollywood for producing quality movies.
It's a nightmare. It's a universal problem. But they kind of... the way it's being done here, it's alarming, you know, when your film gets pirated and people flashes it in your face and nobody is doing anything. And when you even complain, they want to beat you up, like there's no law in the land. All my film has been pirated, but the most painful one is October 1, which has not even been released on DVD.
Every week in Lagos alone, millions of pirated Nollywood and Bollywood movies compete for customers against the original product. The pirated copies are sold everywhere on sidewalks, street corners, under bridges, and even on top of wheelbarrows for about $1. Nigeria's Copyright Commission says the government is doing all it can to combat piracy. Afam Ezekudu is the Director General of the Copyright Commission.
The proactive enforcement and prosecution activities of the Commission over the last 4.5 years, we have actually reduced the rate of piracy. We are not boasting of trying to eliminate or eradicate piracy in this society, but we have done a lot in terms of trying to limit the impact of piracy.
Still, industry analysts like economist David Omidrian believe Nollywood could be much more profitable and grow even further to boost the oil-producing economy.
The industry is growing about 13% per annum, so we could expect the industry to grow by instantaneously maybe 40% and then consistently for at least the next 4 or 5 years.
Since its inception nearly 20 years ago, the Nigerian movie industry has remained one of the largest employers in the country. And analysts say the industry earns the third highest revenues in the world after Hollywood and Bollywood. Paul Ndiho, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Joe DiCapua in Washington. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Zubair Taeb, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The recent terrorist attacks across the globe are a reminder that the threat of terrorism has not receded. It has reconstituted and remains grave. The U.S. is committed to using force to protect its citizens and allies and is intensifying the campaign to degrade and ultimately defeat ISIL with new strikes against their leaders, oil fields, and territory. At the same time, said Undersecretary for Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights Sarah Sewell, we must remember that no number of airstrikes, soldiers, or spies can eliminate the complex motives and hateful ideologies that feed terrorism. That is why the U.S. is embracing a broader and more holistic approach to this threat called Countering Violent Extremism, or CVE. CVE calls for addressing the underlying factors that make communities vulnerable to the siren call of violent extremism. It also calls for pushing back against the ideology and propaganda violent extremists wield to lure people to their cause. These factors are complex, contextual, and often only apparent at the community level. As such, they are often beyond the means of national governments alone to address. CVE therefore calls for a much broader set of actors to address these factors through whole-of-society approaches that include local officials, businesses, religious leaders, researchers, women, youth, and even former members of extremist groups. Through this more preventative and holistic approach, CVE seeks to tighten the flow of recruits to the current generation of violent extremist groups while better preventing the next generation of threat. Countering violent extremism is therefore an essential complement to military efforts to defeat the Islamic State. This is not a question of either or, said Undersecretary of State Sewell. This complex and generational threat requires both.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.